Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dr. Walter Dean for the show called Getting It Done. We have an exciting program today, at least I think so. There are so many skeptics today that we find in the field of religion, always questioning one thing or the other, biblical or no matter what. But today, we're going to be answering the question, did Jesus really rise up from the dead? And our main speaker today is Dr. Kirshay of Dr. Kirshay from Emory University will be answering this question. So let's give a listen to his presentation.
He's D.G. Dunn. He's a retired professor from Durham University in the UK. He goes much further. He says that 1 Corinthians 15, verses 3 through 8, is in fact so early that we can be virtually certain that it was codified within months of Jesus' death. Can we compare 400 years on Alexander the Great to months after Jesus' death? That's about as fast as anything can possibly be from historical times. And if you want me to read for you what 1 Corinthians 15 says in these verses, I will do so. It says this, Paul says, "For I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day in accordance with the Scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12, then he appeared to more than 500 brothers at one time, most of whom are still alive, though some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles, and last of all, as to one untimely born, he appeared also to me." Scholars have concluded, James D.G. Dunn, one of them, that this comes from within months after Jesus' death. What is it saying? It is saying that Jesus died and rose from the dead. Now, that doesn't mean this is automatically true. Just because it comes from within months after Jesus' death, that doesn't mean it's automatically true. But what it does mean is the community is preaching Jesus' death and resurrection that soon after he was crucified. And the people who were around at the time of his ministry, the people who claim to have seen him, are still there, which is why Paul says he appeared to the 500 brothers at one time, most of whom are still alive. Why does he put that qualifier in there, most of whom are still alive? Well, he's telling them, look, if you want to see people who have seen the risen Jesus, go verify what I'm saying. Let their testimony be proof for you that this happened. So what is the nature of the evidence we're looking at tonight? I still haven't gotten to the point where we build a case yet. We're just taking a look at the nature of the evidence. Do we throw out the Bible beforehand? No. We see it as historical documents, or at least those parts that purport to be historical. Then we weigh them for how reliable they are. We try to sift past their biases, just like we would for any historical document. And we also have portions that are so early that they're within months, theoretically, after Jesus died, or perhaps a decade or so, but still, a newsflash, according to ancient standards. That's the strength of the historical testimony for what we're going to be looking at tonight. So now that we've seen kind of the weight of the historical records, and we've taken a look at whether or not we can actually investigate the question, let's take a look at the actual arguments. The argument that I'm going to provide for you comes from two scholars, very highly acclaimed scholars within certain circles. One is a distinguished professor at Liberty University. The other is a professor at Houston Baptist University. Their names are Gary Habermas and Michael Lacona. Gary Habermas is an amazing man. He himself went through an extended period of doubt regarding the resurrection, and he made it his doctoral research to investigate the historical evidence for Jesus' resurrection in the mid-70s. Since then, he has read every single scholarly article on the resurrection and on the death of Jesus printed in English, French, and German. He's got a lot of time on his hands, apparently. So he goes through every one in all those three languages, and he catalogs what all these scholars believe. Over 3,500 articles he's read, cataloging what scholars believe. Now, which scholars is he referring to? Atheist, agnostic, skeptical, Hindu, Jewish, Christian, across the theological spectrum. He takes what all of them write, and he catalogs what they conclude. What he has found is that certain facts about Jesus' death and resurrection, or at least the time surrounding his death and resurrection, are so commonly adhered to, not just by Christians, but by non-Christian scholars, that they're virtually unanimous amongst those who are studying the historical Jesus. Once again, there are certain things that pretty much everyone who studies Jesus agrees about Jesus. One of those facts is that Jesus died by crucifixion. About Jesus' death by crucifixion, you have scholars across the board, once again, who agree that it happened. People like Paula Fredrickson, who's an agnostic or an atheist. You have people like Marcus Borg, Bart Ehrman, who's himself agnostic, saying things like this, that Jesus died by crucifixion is as sure as any historical fact can be. If there's anything we can know about the historical Jesus' life, it's that he died by crucifixion. So the scholars across the board are saying, fact number one, Jesus died by crucifixion. Fact number two that Gary Habermas points out is that the disciples of Jesus truly believed he had risen from the dead. The disciples truly believed Jesus had risen from the dead. Again, that doesn't mean he had risen from the dead, but they actually believed it. They weren't lying about it. And fact number three, that not just the disciples of Jesus believed that he had risen from the dead, but enemies of Jesus, specifically Paul, who was Saul of Tarsus, who was arresting Christians at the time, and also those who didn't follow Jesus, such as James, his brother. We know from the Gospels that James was not a follower of Jesus during his lifetime, and yet all of a sudden he becomes a follower of Jesus to when he's willing to die for the fact that Jesus had risen and appeared. So these three facts, Gary argues, as well as Michael Licona, argue that are solidly established within the historical record. So let's take a look at the reasons why we can believe that these three facts occur. Fact number one, did Jesus die by crucifixion or not? The process of crucifixion during Roman history was so thorough that no one in all of Roman history that's been recorded ever survived a full crucifixion. Not one person ever survived a full crucifixion. Why? Let's take a look at what a crucifixion is. When someone is going to be crucified, I'm sorry if this gets a bit graphic, but the fact of the matter is there are people who deny the death of Jesus on the cross. I was one of them. Throughout my young adulthood, I denied that Jesus died on the cross. But when I saw this evidence, for me, this was so compelling that it challenged me. It shook me to my core because the Quran says Jesus did not die by crucifixion, and yet here was the evidence. Here, take a listen to this. The process of crucifixion starts off with flogging, and we see from the gospel that Jesus was also flogged, and this is a normal for the crucifixion process. The flogging involves using a Roman flagrum, a whip. This whip has multiple leather cords that come off of it. Each of these leather cords has multiple leather balls, which on those leather balls have metal dumbbells and shards of sheep bone. So you've got a whip, multiple cords, leather balls with metal dumbbells and shards of sheep bone. The victim is then tied to a flogging post, and this whip is used to hit the victim repeatedly. The whip is designed the way it is because the metal dumbbells cause vasodilation of the blood vessels near the skin. The blood vessels dilate, pain receptors and chemicals are brought closer to the surface of the skin. It's going to hurt a lot, and you're going to bleed a lot. They're very systematic in the way they designed their crucifixion process. The sheep bone was then designed to reach into the skin, latch onto it, and rip it out. People would bleed to death by the flogging process. Some people's intestines fell out during the flogging process because the whip would reach around to their abdomen, weaken the abdominal wall to the point where the intestines fell out. Cicero records that people's arteries and veins were laid bare during the flogging process. That's why it was called the pre-death. People died during the flogging alone. So It's also interesting to note that the people who were doing this to Jesus were not Jewish at this point. These were the Roman soldiers who were flogging Jesus. And the reason why that's important to note is because Jews had a law from the mitzvot, from the Old Testament, that they were not to flog anyone more than 40 times. So Jews would have someone actually counting. As they were flogging, they'd have someone counting how many times a person was flogged, and once they got to 39, they would stop, just in case someone had miscounted. They wanted to make absolutely sure no one broke God's law and went to 40 or 41. Romans, especially at this time, were very spiteful of the Jews. And so oftentimes they'd get to 40 and start whipping even more, just to spite the Jews and their laws. And so the fact that Jesus was being flogged by Romans makes us think there's a chance that his flogging was worse than the average flogging. And there's more reason to think that, actually, because you look at the Gospel of John. In the Gospel of John, it's pretty clear that Pilate, the person who's crucifying and flogging Jesus, doesn't want Jesus to die. He's trying to release him. So he tells the crowd, look, I've crucified him. I've flogged him. Isn't that enough? Isn't that enough? Now, of course, they were expecting him to be flogged already, so what sense does it make for him to say, oh, he's flogged, isn't that enough? It would only make sense if he had flogged him worse than they were expecting. So we have good reason to believe, for two separate reasons, that Jesus was flogged worse than the average person. And as Cicero has said, it's one of the most gruesome processes. If any of you want more information on the crucifixion process, read Martin Hengel's book, Crucifixion. He provides some historical records in there that are so compelling. For example, no one other than Roman non-citizens were allowed to be flogged and crucified. The crucifixion process was so bad that citizens weren't allowed to be crucified. In fact, people have said, let no Roman even think the word crucifixion. That's how painful and devastating and humiliating the flogging and crucifixion process is. But it's not done yet. After a person's skin is hanging off from them in rivets, they are then placed on a cross. Now, that's not a gentle process by any means. The person was often made to carry the cross beam through the streets as a sign of additional humiliation. Look, they could kill you by beheading you if they wanted to. The crucifixion process is designed to humiliate you and weaken you and prolong the process of death. And so Jesus is carrying the cross beam to the place of his crucifixion. And of course, that happens while he's bleeding and naked. They don't allow any clothes while that's happening. Once they get to the place of the crucifixion, their hands are nailed. And hands, by that, in that time, applied to anything from your fingertips to your wrists. They were nailed right here through the ulna and the radius, because that's where your weight could be sustained while you're hanging. Nailed through there. There's a nerve that runs there. It's called the median nerve. This is the major sensory motor nerve of your arm. If you pierce that nerve, your hand is immediately incapacitated. And if you can imagine tapping your funny bone and how much pain that causes, imagine piercing a nail through it. There's a reason why they had to invent a word to describe the crucifixion process and how painful it is. The word excruciating means excruce, off the cross. This is an excruciating process. You've got nails driven through both sides here, and then you have a 7-inch nail driven through your feet. The reason why a nail is driven through your feet is because if they hang you up by just your arms, you're going to hang, and you're not going to be able to breathe out after a while. You're not going to have the strength to pull yourself up in order to breathe. You hang, your rib cage is extended, you don't have the ability to provide that negative pressure to breathe in, and you're going to die of asphyxiation. So what they do is they nail you through your feet so you can push up off your feet to continue breathing. This is not a mercy. It prolongs the death of someone until they decide to finish you off. When they do that, there are multiple ways, but there is always a Roman death blow involved in the process of the crucifixion. These death blows sometimes look like knees being broken. You see in the Gospels that the people next to Jesus, their knees are broken. Why is that? Because if you break someone's knees, they can no longer push up in order to breathe. So they die by suffocating. Or sometimes bodies were lit on fire while still on the cross. In fact, when the Jews were revolting after after Jesus' death, right before the temple was destroyed, one of the things that the Romans did was they crucified Jews in various positions and lit their bodies on fire all around the city of Jerusalem. They said that their bodies lit up the place like torches. People's bodies would be lit on fire. Sometimes people's bodies would be taken down and thrown to a pit of dogs, and the dogs would eat them. In fact, scholar John Dominic Crossan says this is likely what happened to Jesus. He's a member of the Jesus Seminar. You can tell he's not Christian belief. He says that Jesus' body was fed to dogs. Sometimes people's heads were crushed. Now, Jesus, what happened to him? He was speared through the heart. That was the death blow administered to Jesus. The Romans are making absolutely sure you die by this process. And like I said, not a single person ever survived a full Roman crucifixion. I throw the word full in there because one person is recorded to have survived a partial crucifixion. He was put up on the cross and immediately taken down because a general saw him and recognized him as a friend. So he said, take him down. This is Josephus. They took him down, gave him the best medical treatment they had. In fact, three were taken down at once. Two of them died. One survived. That's the only person ever recorded to survive any part of a crucifixion, but no one ever survived a full Roman crucifixion. For these reasons, scholars take a look at the evidence and they conclude across the board, Jesus died by crucifixion under Pontius Pilate. And I do want to take a moment here to bring in some extra biblical evidence. This isn't just records found in the Bible. You have people outside the Bible, Jews, Romans, and Greeks, outside the Bible, non-Christians, who are saying that Jesus died by crucifixion. Lucian of Samosata, for example, Josephus, the Talmud, Mara bar Serapion, who is also a Jew. All these people are saying that Jesus died by crucifixion. None of them are Christians. All of them are early. None of that's from the Bible. So we have extra-biblical, non-Christian evidence that corroborates this, which is why it is such a strong claim. Fact number one, Jesus died by crucifixion. Fact number two, the disciples believed, truly believed, Jesus had been risen. Now the disciples were at one time so afraid of fighting and dying that they ran away from Jesus. They ran from him. They weren't willing to stick around when Jesus was being arrested. But something happened. And shortly after Jesus' crucifixion, these people are so willing to say that Jesus had risen and appeared to them, that they're all transformed to the point where they're willing to die for this belief. They're willing to die for the sake that Jesus had risen and appeared to them. Something transformed them from essentially cowards to essentially bold enough to not be afraid of death. What was it? What could that possibly be? Now, they're saying it was the resurrection. They saw the author of life himself risen from the dead. That's why they had that kind of boldness to die, because they know death had been defeated. But on top of that, we have other reasons to believe that they were telling the truth. And that is something very pithy that Mike Lacona says. He says, liars make poor martyrs. Liars make poor martyrs. They died for their beliefs. Now, someone might say, Nabil, people died for their beliefs all the time. We saw people in 9/11 willing to kill themselves for the sake of their beliefs. Are they right too? That's not the point I'm making. Because what people believe today and are willing to die for is usually beliefs that were taught to them from the ancient past. The disciples were testifying to something they would have seen with their own eyes. Not something that they had been taught, something they would know to be true or not. And that's why they make poor martyrs, and they're probably not lying. If they were lying, they'd make poor martyrs. So, did the disciples honestly believe Jesus had risen from the dead? Across the board, Gary Habermas has said over 90% of the scholars who study this say yes, and we've just provided the reasons. Finally, fact number three. Did enemies of Jesus believe that he had risen and appeared to them? Now, Paul, like I said earlier, was someone who was arresting Christians. He had no reason to accept or want to see the risen Jesus. He hadn't followed Jesus. He hadn't been one of his disciples. In fact, he was a student of a top rabbi of the time, Gamaliel, one of the highest rabbis, and he was one of his best students. He had power coming his way. He had plenty of reason to want to stay within the Orthodox sect of Judaism and not follow this new Christian subsection of Jews. So why in the world would he have been willing to die, and in fact did die, for the claim that Jesus had risen from the dead? Once again, the argument is made that he truly believed Jesus had risen from the dead. Now, whether he's right or not, we haven't gotten to yet. But he at least truly believed Jesus had risen from the dead. And James as well, the brother of Jesus. You take a look at Mark chapter 6, and what you find is that Jesus' family is not following him. Jesus' family is not one of those who is agreeing with the early Christian community. They're saying Jesus is out of his mind. But James, the brother of Jesus, we see in the book of Acts, and we also see from extra-biblical evidence, that James, in fact, was not just a follower of Jesus, he became a leader of the church in Jerusalem. And then he was killed for believing Jesus had risen from the dead. The evidence that he was killed is found extra-biblically, like I said, in Josephus, in the second century of Hegesippus as well. We have good records showing that James and Paul, neither of which were following Jesus, were willing to go to their death for the fact that Jesus had risen. Therefore, they believed Jesus had truly risen. Are you with me so far on these three facts? Jesus died by crucifixion, the disciples truly believed he had risen from the dead, and the enemies of Jesus truly believed he had risen from the dead. Here is the job of a historian, and this is where we draw everything together. The job of a historian is to take evidence and facts from history and provide an account that best explains those facts. You see, an array of facts, what theory best explains those facts? If you have a theory that strains the facts, that's a bad historical conclusion. If you have a theory that accounts for the facts very well and comfortably, that's a good historical conclusion. Now, it should be said up front, no theory accounts for all the facts perfectly, but some definitely account for the facts better than other theories do. So what theory can best account for these three facts that we have just investigated, that virtually all scholars across the board who study this matter are in agreement with? I'm positing tonight, based on the minimal facts argument of Habermas and Lakota, that the only hypothesis that answers these facts well is the resurrection. No other hypothesis comes even close to explaining these facts. That's my argument tonight. Now let's assess that for a moment. The hypothesis of the resurrection, does it explain fact number one, that Jesus died on the cross? Yes, it accounts for that. Jesus died on the cross. Number two, does it explain that the disciples of Jesus truly believed that they had seen him risen? Yes, it does. If Jesus rose from the dead and they saw him, that explains why they truly believed that they had seen him. Fact number three, does it explain that enemies of Jesus truly believed that they had seen him risen? Yes, once again, if Jesus actually rose from the dead, that accounts for all three of those facts. It accounts also for why enemies of Jesus believe they had seen him risen. Hypothesis number two. Now, I'll tell you this. Gary Habermas has said that this hypothesis is the most popular hypothesis after the resurrection. But that said, only 5% of the scholars he surveyed believe in this. It's the most popular after the resurrection. But only 5% of the scholars he surveyed believe in this alternative explanation. It's the hallucination theory that Jesus' disciples had followed Jesus and they so wanted to see him risen that after he died, they saw him risen. And how are they explaining this? Well, it's a true medical phenomenon. When people lose loved ones, they often hallucinate their loved ones' return. They hallucinate that they're back. So, appealing to that medical phenomenon of hallucinations of the recently bereaved, they're saying that the disciples really saw Jesus risen. They believed that they had seen him risen, but it was just a hallucination. Okay, so that's that hypothesis. Does it fit the three facts? Fact number one, if they were just hallucinating, does the fact that Jesus died on the cross fit? Yes, it fits. It fits that theory. Number two, if the disciples were just hallucinating, does it fit the fact that they truly believed they had seen him risen? Well, this is a bit of a stretch. This is a bit of a stretch. Because it's not like there's one person who saw Jesus risen. Like I said, from something that maybe as early as 6 months after Jesus, 500 people at once saw the risen Jesus, or at least believed that they had seen the risen Jesus. So in order to avoid the miracle of the resurrection, you have to create a miracle of a mass hallucination. Doesn't work. But for the sake of argument, let's just say, okay, fine, it fits fact number two. Fact number three. the enemies of Jesus truly believed that they had seen him risen. Does this fit? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Under the hypothesis that the disciples really wanted to see Jesus risen, therefore they did, how does that explain the fact that Paul saw the risen Jesus? It doesn't explain that Paul didn't want to see anything but he wanted to see the risen Jesus. Yet Paul was willing to die for the fact that he had seen the risen Jesus. So the hypothesis that the disciples simply hallucinated doesn't fit the facts. What about the next most common hypothesis? After that, you're going to look at the stolen body theory, that the disciples stole Jesus' body. Well, does that fit fact number one, that Jesus died by crucifixion? Yes, it does. Does it fit fact number two, that the disciples truly believed that they had seen Jesus risen? No. If they stole his body, they didn't truly believe that they had seen him risen. It doesn't fit this fact. And, of course, it doesn't fit fact number three either. Why were enemies of Jesus willing to say they had seen him risen if it was just that the body had been stolen? Doesn't fit the facts. All right, what's the next most common hypothesis? And this was a hypothesis that I had believed, that Jesus had simply swooned on the cross. He didn't die, he survived the crucifixion. Does it fit fact number one? No. Fact number one is that he died on the cross. And to argue that he didn't die doesn't fit the facts. But also, it doesn't really fit fact number two either, that the disciples believed he had risen from the dead. Because if the disciples had simply healed Jesus after he had survived the cross, they wouldn't be then willing to die for the proclamation that he had risen from the dead. It doesn't fit the facts. And David Strauss, who was an atheist from the 18th century, was the first person to point this out. Back then, naturalistic explanations were pretty popular to explain what was happening to Jesus. David Strauss, a vocal atheist at the time, which is very rare, said this hypothesis simply does not work because the disciples went from being afraid to proclaiming Jesus the author of life. Now, if Jesus had just barely survived a crucifixion, that doesn't make him the author of life. That doesn't give them enough reason to proclaim the resurrection. And once again, of course, it doesn't quite fit with enemies of Jesus as well. From this point, we start going really downhill on the hypotheses. The next most common hypothesis is the evil twin hypothesis. Jesus had an evil twin who saw this moment to take control and take power and then apparently disappeared. Who knows? That's the next hypothesis, not really a good one. After that, we get into the super alien hypothesis. So it just goes even further downhill. The fact is that the best explanation for the facts surrounding Jesus' death is that he rose from the dead. It's the only explanation that works well. And because it's the only explanation that works well, you have, remember how I said that after the resurrection itself, the next most common hypothesis was only subscribed to by 5% of people. There's a whole host of people in there who say this. We don't know what happened. We don't know what happened. Most of the scholars studying Jesus' life conclude, we simply don't know. There's no historical explanation that can account for these facts. Well, I think there is. It's called the resurrection. Now, the only reason why people would preclude that beforehand is if they say miracles can't count. But if you rule out miracles before you start the investigation, you're not being fair. You are being biased in your research. And you've beforehand precluded the potential, and I would say the best explanation. This is why the same scholar I talked about earlier, Reza Aslan, said this. He said, something extraordinary happened. What exactly that something was is impossible to know. Jesus' resurrection is an exceedingly difficult topic for historians to discuss, not least because it falls beyond the scope of the examination of the historical Jesus. So he's saying what most historians say. But he says, however, there is this nagging fact to consider. One after another, those who claim to have witnessed the risen Jesus went to their own gruesome death, refusing to recant their testimony. So even scholars like Reza Aslan, who says, we don't know what happened, he grants the facts. He's just not willing to conclude a resurrection because he thinks that would be a miracle. And I think that's exactly what happened. So we can at least conclude that there's good reason for Christians to have faith in the resurrection of Jesus because it is the best explanation of the historical evidence. No other explanation approximates this. Now, what I want to leave you with then is the fact that this isn't just an academic lecture. This isn't just a matter we study in order to ascertain the reliability of Christianity or to see why they believe what they believe. This has real ramifications for all of us who are sitting here. If we are living in a world where only natural things happen, and post-Enlightenment, especially in university settings, it seems to be a popular belief in the West that only natural things happen, that there is no such thing as the supernatural. What this means, what the resurrection means then, is that that is wrong. There's something more to this world, something that can bring people back from the dead. And if that is true, then what that means for you is that if it comes to a point in your life where it seems like there is no hope, if it comes to a point in your life where it seems like even death is inevitable and there's no way to escape it, well, death is not the end. There's more. There's hope no matter what. Now, if it's someone who has risen from the dead, that's what that means. But the fact that it was Jesus who had risen from the dead tells us even more. Because what Jesus had been claiming was that you could live in eternity with God, that He loves you, that God loves you, and that He will provide for you. And His resurrection was the proof He was providing for these claims. Now, if it's true that you have Jesus, He's been risen from the dead, His claims have been proven true, then that what that means is that you can be with God for eternity if you follow Jesus. That means that your life here can be spent poured out for the sake of others. That means you don't have to be worried about anything in your own life because you're in the hands of a God who's all-powerful and all-loving, who loves you in specific. That filters down to such a high level. Jesus was that person who was willing to spend time with sinners and prostitutes and tax collectors, according to the New Testament. Jesus was that person who was loving even the lowest of the low. So right now we have in Atlanta tens of thousands of people trapped in sex slavery. And I'm telling you, some of the things that keep them there is the constant lie that they are told that they aren't worth anything. They're told that the best use that they have is their body being sold for money. They're being told that verbally, they're being told that by the actions under which they are trapped. And quite frankly, if there is no supernatural, if all we are is the chemicals that comprise us, then they're not worth anything more than that. And the most value we can extract from them is utilitarianism, which is what's happening to them. They're spawning this industry by their bodies being sold. But if God, if Jesus, if the gospel message is true, if Jesus' resurrection happened, which provides epistemic basis to believe in the gospel, then that means that even that person caught in sex slavery can believe that they are loved. Not just by anyone, by the God who created the universe. Not just that they are loved, but they're so valuable that God Himself would be willing to die for them and then willing to defeat death for them. No message can give someone more value than that. This has very real ramifications. And for us here, for those of us here who do live in Atlanta, if this message is true, if Jesus is risen from the dead, then we ought to follow Him and follow what He says. And what He says is be willing to suffer and die for the sake of those who need you. Be willing to pour your life out for those who need you. If Jesus died on the cross for the sake of us, which is what He said and which is what He would have proven if He had risen from the dead, He tells us, love your neighbor as yourself. Well, who is our neighbor? Those very people caught in sex slavery. He gives us a reason to then empty ourselves out for their sake. And this might be hard to swallow, not just for their sake, but the sake of their captors and the criminals as well. We're supposed to love everyone because they are truly valuable and worthy of love. This all becomes true if Jesus is risen from the dead. This has tremendous ramifications, and I think it's an amazing blessing, speaking from a Christian perspective, that God has given us reason to believe in it. He didn't have to, but the history is that strong that we can have solid reason to believe in it, not just have to believe in it by blind faith, but be able to put our claim on this, on the strength of the historical evidence. And based on that, lives are being transformed. Mine is one of them. Mine is one of them. I would have never said anything like this if the case for the resurrection had not been this strong. But because it is, I'm willing to follow Jesus. And the question is, where do you fall? Thank you so much for giving me a hearing. We're going to now go into question and answers. Thanks.
That was a fantastic presentation. The person, if you were not a believer prior to listening to this sobering presentation, there evidently you probably had much more knowledge about the resurrection of Jesus Christ. I've known about the resurrection of Jesus Christ ever since I was a child and able to remotely understand the English language. Sometimes I even imagine myself having to go through what he went through, which is highly impossible. It's just hard to believe as you get older, you understand that that's one of the things that's not possible. But we're going to continue. The next part of this is called Four Historical Facts That Prove Jesus Really Did Rise from the Dead. And we're going to listen to that particular segment right now by the John
Today,
Rockenberg
the Johnny Kirk Show. Why would anyone believe that Jesus Christ was crucified and died on a cross in Jerusalem, was buried in the tomb, and then rose from the dead 3 days later? You may be surprised to learn that there are four historical facts that are accepted by the majority of New Testament scholarship today that lead to the conclusion that Jesus really did rise from the dead. What are these facts? Today, you will find out on this special edition of the John Ankerberg Show. Hi, I'm John Ankerberg. Thanks for joining me. Our topic today is an important one. Are there four historical facts that lead to the conclusion that Jesus rose from the dead? My guest today will tell us is Dr. William Lane Craig, who holds a PhD in philosophy from the University of Birmingham in England, and a Doctor of Theology degree from the University of Munich. Now, the historical evidence surrounding Jesus' resurrection was of such interest to him that he wrote his doctoral dissertation on this at the University of Munich. And what he discovered, he said, shocked him. I'd like you to listen why. Having studied the Kalam cosmological argument for my philosophical doctorate, I wanted to follow up by doing doctoral studies in Germany under one of the world's leading German theologians, Wolfhard Pannenbach. And I wrote my doctoral dissertation on the historicity of Jesus' resurrection. Now, as a Christian, I already believed in the resurrection of Jesus. But I must say, John, that as a result of my study, I was absolutely astonished, really taken aback by the fact that the facts undergirding the inference to the resurrection of Jesus are today acknowledged by the wide majority of New Testament historians who have investigated the historical Jesus. And that quite shocked me. These are not the conclusions peculiar to conservative scholars or evangelical scholars, but these represent the majority view of the wide spectrum of New Testament scholarship today, including persons who teach at non-evangelical seminaries and universities and non-Christian scholars, such as Jewish scholars today. So the fundamental facts that undergird the inference to Jesus' resurrection are quite firmly established and recognized by the majority of New Testament criticism.
Yeah, and you say that there are four historical facts that any serious historian that's investigating this topic must deal with. And these four facts are accepted by the majority of critical scholars of every stripe and flavor What are those four historical facts?
They can be conveniently grouped in these following four headings. Number one, that Jesus of Nazareth was given a proper burial following his crucifixion in a tomb by a member of the Jewish Sanhedrin named Joseph of Arimathea. Second fact is that that tomb was then discovered empty by a group of Jesus' female followers on the Sunday morning after his crucifixion. Thirdly, is that various individuals and groups of people under a variety of circumstances and at various locales experienced appearances of Jesus alive after his death. And finally, number four, that the original disciples suddenly and sincerely came to believe that God had raised Jesus from the dead despite their having every predisposition to the contrary.
Yeah, take the first one, the honorable burial of Jesus.
The burial of Jesus is so important because if the site of Jesus' grave were known in Jerusalem to both Jew and Christian alike, then it is impossible that a movement founded upon belief in the resurrection of Jesus could arise and flourish in Jerusalem in the face of a tomb containing his corpse. So the burial of Jesus is a very important step toward the inference to the empty tomb. And most scholars recognize that the burial account of Jesus is, in fact, historical. First of all, it is attested in independent early sources. This is one of the most important criteria that historians use in assessing the historicity of any event. If an event is independently attested in early sources, then it's much less likely to have been made up, but actually represents the facts. And in the case of Jesus' burial, we have multiple early sources for the fact of Jesus' burial in the tomb. First would be the pre-Markan passion story, that is to say, the story of the final week of Jesus' life that was used by Mark in writing his gospel. This is one of the earliest sources behind the New Testament and probably goes back to within 10 years after Jesus' death to the eyewitnesses. A second early source would be the tradition that Paul passes on in his first letter to the church in Corinth, Greece. There Paul recites this formula that he himself received and then passed on to the Corinthians. And that formula says, Christ died for our sins in accordance with the scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day in accordance with the scriptures, and he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12. And the second line of that formula refers to Jesus' burial. This formula passed on by Paul has been dated to within the first 5 years after Jesus' crucifixion. Thus, we have independent attestation of Jesus' burial in two of the earliest sources behind the New Testament, not to mention a number of other sources. So that we have very good grounds for believing that, in fact, Jesus was buried in the tomb as the pre-Markan Passion story relates.
Yeah, let me just stop right there and say that a lot of our listeners may find it interesting to hear that the gospel writers used sources.
Mm-hmm.
But Luke actually said that in his preface. He examined all of these things before he wrote. He got together the information like a kid doing a term paper, and he used different sources that he thought were credible. In Luke's case, it was eyewitnesses. Mark's comes together, and the scholars can tell that this is one continuous flow of information.
That's right.
And Mark used this early source. Scholars can document this. This is what you're talking about.
That's right. That's exactly right. Now, a second reason to think that the burial story is accurate is the criterion of embarrassment. This criterion states that if an incident or event is awkward or embarrassing for the early Christian church, then it's more likely to be historical. And the story of the burial by Joseph of Arimathea passes this criterion. Jesus was not buried by his family members or by his devoted disciples. Instead, they all deserted him. And instead, he's buried by a member of the hated Sanhedrin, the Jewish court, all of whom, Mark says, voted to condemn Jesus to the cross. So the burial by Joseph of Arimathea is very probable historically. It is highly unlikely that the early Christians would have invented a story about a member of the Sanhedrin giving Jesus a proper burial in a tomb if this had not been, in fact, the case. So I find this just amazing that we actually know the name of the man who was responsible for the interment of Jesus of Nazareth. This is just astonishing. John A.T. Robinson, professor of New Testament studies at Cambridge University and someone very far from a conservative or evangelical, summarizes it by saying that the burial of Jesus in the tomb is one of the earliest and best attested facts about Jesus.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to fact number two that the majority of critical scholars accept, and it's this. On the Sunday following the crucifixion, Jesus' tomb was found empty by a group of his women followers. One critical scholar thinks that this fact points to the historical credibility of the empty tomb story.
Well, again, the empty tomb account is attested in independent and early sources. We have around six different independent sources attesting to the fact of the discovery of Jesus' empty tomb. One of these, again, would be the pre-Markan passion story. The passion story does not end with the burial. The empty tomb story is part of the passion account. It is linked to the burial account by grammatical and linguistic ties. It really is one narrative, and the story does not end until the discovery of the empty tomb. Similarly, in that pre-Pauline formula that Paul quotes in his letter to the church in Corinth, the third line of the saying says, "And he was raised on the third day in accordance with the scriptures." Now, there are two indications there that the empty tomb sticks behind this line of the saying. First, when you compare the four lines of the saying to the gospel accounts on the one hand and the sermons in the Acts of the Apostles, what you find is that the first line corresponds to the crucifixion, the second line, and that he was buried, corresponds to the burial account. The third line, he was raised on the third day, corresponds to the empty tomb story. And then he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12, corresponds to the story of the appearances. So that what Paul is giving is a sort of sermon outline, if you will, in which the third point of the outline is the empty tomb story. The other indication is the phrase, on the third day. Why do they use this terminology? Well, to make a long story short, this is most probable because it was on the third day, according to Jewish reckoning, that the women found the tomb empty. And so naturally the resurrection came to be dated on that day. So in Paul's information, we also have very early evidence for the empty tomb. We also have other independent sources behind Luke and Matthew, the sermons in the Acts of the Apostles, so that the empty tomb story is abundantly attested in independent early sources. Historians think that they've hit historical pay dirt if they can find two independent early accounts of an event. But in the case of the empty tomb story, we have around six such independent early sources.
All right, then come on back to the women. Why is the fact that it's recorded that women found the tomb empty, why do critical scholars think that this fact points to the historical credibility of the empty tomb story?
This is one of the best examples of the criterion of embarrassment at work. Remember, the criterion of embarrassment says that if a fact or incident is embarrassing or awkward for the Christian movement, it's unlikely to have been made up by them. The discovery of the empty tomb by women is such a fact. In first century Jewish society, the testimony of women was regarded as so worthless that they wouldn't be believed. The Jewish historian Josephus actually says that the testimony of women should not even be admitted into court because of the levity and brashness of their sex. So women witnesses were worthless. Secondly, it also shows how the disciples had deserted Jesus. Any later legendary account would have Peter and John come and discover the empty tomb, not women whose testimony was worthless. So the fact that it is women who are the discoverers of and principal witnesses to the fact of the empty tomb is best explained by the fact that, like it or not, they were the discoverers of the empty tomb, and the gospel writers record what for them was a rather awkward and embarrassing fact.
You say another indication of the credibility of the empty tomb account is the fact that very enemies of the earliest disciples presupposed the empty tomb. What are you talking about?
I'm talking about the effort in the 28th chapter of the Gospel of Matthew to refute the earliest Jewish response to the disciples' proclamation of Jesus' resurrection. What were Jews saying in response to the disciples' proclamation, "He is risen from the dead"? Were they saying, "His body's still there in the tomb, in the garden," or "These men are drunk with new wine"? No, they were saying the disciples came by night and stole away his body. Now think about that for a minute. The disciples came by night and stole away his body. The earliest Jewish response to the proclamation of the resurrection was itself an attempt to explain why the body was missing. And so the Jewish authorities entangled themselves in this hopeless series of absurdities trying to explain away the empty tomb. This is evidence for the historicity of the empty tomb that is absolutely top drawer, because it comes not from the early Christian movement, but from the very enemies of the Christians who themselves testify to the fact that the body was gone.
Fantastic. Let's go to fact number three. You say that the third historical fact accepted by the majority of critical scholars is that on multiple occasions and under various circumstances, different individuals and groups of people experienced appearances of Jesus alive from the dead. It's amazing that critical scholars agree with this fact.
And this is a fact, John, which I think virtually 100% of critical historians acknowledge. I cannot think of any that would deny the fact of these postmortem experiences of seeing Jesus alive. One reason for this is that Paul provides a list of such eyewitnesses in this early Christian tradition in his letter to the church in Corinth, Greece. The final line of that saying is, "Then he appeared to Cephas," that's the Aramaic word for Peter, the chief disciple. He appeared to Peter, then to the 12. That means the 12 disciples. Then Paul begins to add in his own words additional witnesses that he's aware of. He says, "Then he appeared to more than 500 brethren at one time, most of whom are still alive, though some have died. Then he appeared to James," that would be Jesus' younger brother, "and the church leader in Jerusalem." And then Paul says, finally, "to all the apostles. Then last of all, as to one untimely born," says Paul, "he appeared also to me." And on the basis of the earliness of this information, as well as Paul's personal contact with people like Peter and James, every New Testament scholar acknowledges that these early individuals and groups did experience these appearances of Jesus alive after his death. Now, you can try to explain these away as hallucinations if you want to, but you cannot responsibly deny that they occurred.
C.H. Dodd also mentioned this very fact. Talk about this.
Well, it's so interesting that Paul doesn't just list the appearance to the 500 brethren, But he adds this parenthetical comment that most of them are still alive, though some have died. Now, why does he add that? Well, one of the characteristics of ancient historical writing was to list the eyewitnesses whom inquirers could go and speak with about the event. And so Paul is saying, in effect, the witnesses are there to be questioned. Paul knew that these witnesses were still about, and you can tell that this isn't just speculation on his part, because he was aware that some had died, and he mentions that, but the others were still about and could be interrogated if one wanted to talk to them about what they had seen.
So talk about Jesus' younger brother, James. Why is he so important to scholars that he's a part of that list?
This is so remarkable, John, that in this list of appearances, it includes James, Jesus' younger brother. This is remarkable because neither James nor any of Jesus' other brothers apparently believed in him during his lifetime. They didn't think he was the Messiah. They didn't think he was a prophet. They didn't think he was anybody special. Indeed, there are some stories in the Gospels that suggest they thought that Jesus was crazy. And yet, in the book of Acts, all of a sudden, Jesus' family turns up in the upper room in worship with the other Christians. And eventually, James emerges as one of the leaders in the New Testament church. He eventually becomes the sole elder of the church in Jerusalem. That's all we hear about James in the New Testament. But from Josephus, the Jewish historian, we learn that James, the younger brother of Jesus, was martyred for his faith in the mid-AD 60s during a lapse in the civil government when the Sanhedrin illegally stoned him to death. Now, think of this. What would cause James to move from becoming an unbeliever and skeptic about his older brother to being willing to die for his belief in Jesus as Messiah? Jesus' crucifixion would only confirm in James' mind that his older brother was delusory. Can there be any doubt that the reason for this transformation in James is what Paul says? Then he appeared to James. Now, most of us have brothers. What would it take for you to believe that your brother is the Lord so that you would be ready to die for that belief? Can there be any doubt that this transformation in James is due to the fact that he did experience an appearance of Jesus risen from the dead?
Yeah. The fourth historical fact, which any critical historical hypothesis concerning the fate of Jesus of Nazareth has to explain is this, is the very origin of the disciples' belief that God had raised Jesus of Nazareth from the dead. What do you mean?
It's an indisputable historical datum, again acknowledged by all New Testament historians, that the early followers of Jesus sincerely and suddenly came to believe that God had raised Jesus from the dead. Now, how do you explain the origin of this extraordinary belief? This belief is so un-Jewish. According to Jewish thinking, Messiah was not supposed to be executed. He was supposed to establish David's throne in Jerusalem. The crucifixion of Jesus was a catastrophe for these early disciples. It would be impossible for them to continue to believe that Jesus was Messiah, confronted with his crucifixion and burial in the tomb. Secondly, Jewish beliefs about the afterlife precluded anyone's rising from the dead to glory and immortality before the general resurrection at the end of the world. Confronted with Jesus' suffering, death, and entombment, the disciples could at most have preserved their master's tomb as a shrine where pilgrimages might be held and where they would await for the general resurrection at the end of the world when they and their master would be united in the kingdom of God. But they wouldn't come to believe that he was already risen from the dead, contrary to Jewish thinking and their own plain eyesight. And yet it's indisputable that these early disciples did come to believe that God had raised Jesus from the dead, despite every predisposition to the contrary. It seems to me that the best explanation for this extraordinary transformation in the disciples is the one that they gave. God raised Jesus from the dead. And
ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to Getting It Done by Dr. Dean. And we're listening to a second part of the historical fact that proved Jesus Christ did rise from the dead. You don't have to go through a school or to some philosophical structure to understand that it had to happen, because that's the only way that he was able to defeat the thing called death by him coming back and explaining it to us. Well, next week we're going to try to do the same kind of thing that we've done today. I have a show, of course, on Friday, but that starts at 4:30. This one starts every Monday at 5 o'clock. I hope you enjoyed what you've had an opportunity to hear, and look forward to you being able to listen to the show again next week. This has been Getting It Done with the host, myself, Dr. Dean.